flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red. For the last time this season, the lights change.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. When we never said that.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 304 for Wednesday, the 1st of February, 2012. My name is Martin Darlington. I am in the northern bit of Wales and across the pond in California. I'm joined, as ever, by Jim Race. Evening, Jim. How are you doing?
Good midday to you, Martin.
Of course, yes.
It is always funny doing a... The show is a very interesting beast to try and tame sometimes because, and it's the same thing during race weekends when they're racing in the Europe, in that your hours get so skewed and it's, you know, it is kind of odd, I guess, in a way that I've got a co-host that is, you know, we should measure the nautical miles sometime. Cause I guess you're about 9,000 miles away, but it certainly does make for a great mix.
Oh, yeah. But it's been like that this week with the Sepang test, which obviously we will be able to talk about. That, you know, it's great because it's so many hours ahead for us. During the morning, I've been away teaching down at HQ. But in between flights, I could just catch up with what's going on. But then by like mid-morning, they're saying, yep, that's it. We're all going back to the hotel. That's us finished for the day. And you're like, oh.
Yeah,
right.
and for me, they're 16 hours ahead. And so... Yeah. You know, I'm up until God knows when, and trying to balance that with, you know, taking care of just general life is a bit of a challenge. But to be honest, Twitter has probably been one of the best sources of information during those tests of anywhere.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
There's enough people there to keep us sort of up. And then, of course, in the afternoon, so you can have the discussion about what it all means. Yeah. And everyone is reading far too much into them. As we knew we would do, and we're probably about to do exactly the same.
I'm sure we will. There was some very interesting banter going back and forth between HRC and Yamaha MotoGP Twitter feeds, which cracked me up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant stuff.
Absolutely. And it was interesting to see being stirred up by various naughty people like Ian Wheeler, for one, dropping comments in here and there.
Speaking of Ian Wheeler... I did have a couple of convos with him, and he did manage to get me set up with an interview with Scott Redding, which I did last night. Some of you out there will be pleased because it's a very short one. we also have a bunch of interviews that Jules is going to collate and put together that Phil Hall, who is a friend of the show and has been around for quite some time, former Bathurst announcer, if I believe, for that endurance race, did with a whole bunch of different riders down at Phillip Island during the classic races, which just occurred over this last weekend. And that will include an interview that Jules did with Ed Hauser, who's another friend of the show from California, who went down to run them. So might even have another mystery guest. I'm pretty excited. This should be a good show, not as long as normal. But again, and let me address that real quick. I know that our shows have been fairly long of late. And part of that is because we get back from our vacation, our winter break, if you will, and we have a tendency to try and get as much stuff in as we can. But at the same time, we also, what's the term that I'm looking for, Martin?
Overcompensate.
They could say something about that. And the other thing that I do want to, anyway, the shows will get shorter as the season progresses, unless all of us waffle on. I love that term too, by the way. I picked that up from you guys. I also want to address very briefly our audio issues, because I know that it sounds at times like that I'm speaking from inside of a metal garbage can. And so we're going to fix that. We're taking steps to do so to get me a proper studio so that, my discussions with these guys that you all want to hear, my sound doesn't detract from the content of the interview. And so we are aware of it, and it's something that we're working on improving. So just wanted to let you all know.
Excellent. We've had various bits of feedback, lots of really, really positive feedback regarding last week's show, which I'd like to add my tuppennyworth to. I mean, Simon Crafer was absolutely brilliant. Josh Hayes, you know, you've spoken to him before, always very forthcoming. Very interesting what he had to say about Valencia and riding in place of Colin. And nice to hear him giving props to Cal. Obviously, they get on anyway. Yeah. And then Andrew Wheeler Andrew's always fantastic to talk to. The anecdotes are just hilarious. And it was funny when he was talking about Donington, because we were there for that one in the wet. Mm-hmm. I remember the Lorenzo crash when his suit didn't deflate. So right. He went stalking off looking like, some kind of pumped up superhero, but
Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a lot of positive feedback, but the one that we're actually going to pick out was a listener, Tim Jackson, who attends both PI and Sepang as often as he can. So I'm guessing he's probably Australian, but stand to be corrected on that, Tim. And if you're not, I do apologise. But he was keen to say how much he enjoys the podcast, but he also. And this is the bit that took me aback a bit. He feels we're a bit of a Valentino Rossi love-in show. And he said, you know, like all the others, and we spend a lot of time bashing Casey Stoner. Now, I do remember when first Jules and Bob and then Jules and yourself, Jim, had to deal with, you know, people accusing us of having a go at Casey. And I was just thinking, hang on, Tim. That's Martin, have to reply. I think both Jim and Jules are really, really objective. And I'm not. But that's not because I'm a Rossi fan. It's because I'm a publicly confessed fan of Jorge Lorenzo. Not the man, because I don't know him necessarily, but the rider. Lorenzo, I nailed my colours to his mast some time ago, and I see no reason to change. And all of us have since pretty much 2007, and remember Bob's perfect storm of Ducati, Bridgestone, Tyson, Casey, you know, we have heralded the arrival of the new hungry, super talented riders who have barged their way through and are now in between Valentino and any further titles. Not to say he couldn't win another one. Personally, I don't think it's likely at all. And I'd go so far as to make a bold prediction. Big John Hart, if you're listening, you can double or quits on that lorry load of beer, you know, Omi. I'll say Rossi won't win a dry race this year. Unless there's a major pile-up ahead, and that means we have to lose at least two of Lorenzo, Stoner, or Pedrosa. And no one on this show, and bear in mind, I haven't missed one either as co-host or listener and fan before that for something like 5 years. No one's ever criticised Casey for anything other than being a bit whiny when things haven't gone his way. And everyone has to admit that he has at times been a bit whiny, but it's started to go away. He's maturing. I mean, he's still a kid. He's still, he's only in his mid-20s, early to mid-20s. He's not Rossi, but no one expects him to be. And for myself, I increasingly like the lad. He's been a lot more cheerful than the last year or so. And I like his blunt manner. It's that Mick Doohan sort of, I'm here to win races. Don't expect me to be nice or say anything to amuse you, bunch of tossers. You know, and he is getting easier going. So hopefully in the future, Tim, we'll hear the comments we have to make about Casey, both good and bad, as they may be, but he'll hear them without a preconception that we're looking for a reason, for a weapon to bash him with. Because, he's an utterly worthy double world champion. He's different. Lorenzo's different. Yeah. You know, and I think it's quite refreshing. And there was a Twitter conversation the other day about Lorenzo and a couple of girls were sort of saying, ooh, don't know, starting to like him a bit more, but, you know, why did he feel he had to be Rossi? And I can only presume that's based on the after-race celebration. I'm thinking, so anyone who ever does anything after a race now is going to be told, well, you're just copying Rossi. You know, yeah, people have done that for a long time. Rossi did
Do you remember when Biaggi was getting bashed when he won the World Superbike Championship because he was trying to be Rossi-esque?
Oh, yeah, but that was a bit cringeworthy, that one, wasn't it? No, I think Jorge's best one was the best way to go down, you know, in history is to die young. So he decided to drown himself in the lake. But, it was at Jerez and he went and jumped in the lake. It's like, yeah.
Yes. Still a classic. I mean, when you have to have people actually save your life because you've put yourself in a situation for...
who was it who pointed out to us that the person who dragged him out was wearing a Repsol t-shirt?
Yeah. Absolute classic. Hey, you know, before we dive fairly further into this, you want to try a synchronized beer opening, Mark Martin?
Okie doke. Here we go, ready? Then.
Count of
three. Three, two, one.
Ah, stereo even.
There we go. Don't know how we did there, but.
Yeah, hopefully we're properly synced up. Yeah, you know, I Jules responded to it very wisely in email, to Tim's email, and it kind of caught me a little bit off guard, too. We get a ton of feedback, not only through email, but obviously through the Facebook fan page. And I will have to mention, since we're here right now, we just topped 10,000 fans on the Facebook fan page, and it's still going strong.
How cool is that?
That's very cool. And I managed to grab a screenshot of it. And so to all of you out there that enjoy the show, thank you. Facebook.com/motopod. You can find us there. I was very stoked to kind of see that up, and it's been creeping up there for the last few days. And kind of getting excited about it. It's a very interesting landmark. Now, the question that occurred to me this morning, Martin, was, all right, so what's our next milestone? 25K? And I'm willing to shoot for that. May take a while. We'll see how it goes. That is certainly not indicative of how many of you actually listen to the show, but it is kind of neat to have our little community over there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's growing and the word spreading, people are starting to talk about the show in, like, I don't want to do us down, but in proper media outlets, it's, we're getting being quoted on like blogs and websites, and it's really, God, that came out a bit squeaky. I'm not that excited. <It's>, you know, it's really cool. And I think the more people we attract, the more really like constructive and thought-provoking feedback we get, and that it just grows exponentially, and you know,
it does. It feeds back into itself, and it's one of the reasons why we were able to get the quality and caliber of interviews that we've had over the last few shows.
Sure.
But again, that will slow down, you know, when these guys start getting real serious about racing. So those of you out there, and you are in the minority, I might point out, that don't like the really long shows, it will chill out. And frankly, yeah, it's a lot of work for us to even try and do to put together something like that. So we're kind of looking at forward to the reprieve as well.
And I think what we've discussed before, you know, during the season, when we do get a couple of weeks without a any racing to talk about at world level, certainly, then we may well do a longer show, but there'll be 2 or 3 weeks to listen to it in. So,
we'll try and
the difficult one is when we get World Superbike weekend, where you've got two races in the World Supersport race to talk about, and there's a MotoGP weekend, and then there's something the following week, and we've got to try and get all of that into a show and out as early as possible so people can listen to it before the next show starts, before the next weekend starts.
Right. And as we've sort of expanded our coverage to include a fair amount of BSB stuff, obviously TT Macau, things like that. It's hard to not talk about it, but we'll do our best. We'll do our best. We're trying to become less verbose, and here we are being extremely verbose. I'm going to run into the main topics here.
Thanks, fam.
Silly season has still not stopped. And I find it kind of amazing to me. But continues. Damian Kedlin has joined Alain Rossel at the QMMF Racing Moto2 team, replacing Ricky Cardoose. And kind of for reasons unknown at this point, Carter's has apparently joined the Stop and Go Moto 2 team, replacing Kenny Noyes. And I'm still waiting to get some information on that from the man himself, that being Kenny. So hopefully we might have some of that later in the show, if not next week. Ant West has become another casualty of the whole sponsorship deal, you know, that riders seem to need to raise these days. He's been axed out by Speedmaster CRT MotoGP, replaced by Matteo Pessini, which got, in a way, got kind of weird because Ant said, okay, well, I'm going to retire. Well, obviously, Ant's not old enough to retire, and he's got a lot of support from his fans. I've seen that on Facebook, on Twitter, all over the place. So he's working now to try and put together some money. And like you said, Martin, so it's a shame because he's a very, very interesting character and writer. But yeah. Pessini's kind of the same way. And he's one that has been through his sponsorship hardships in the past, too. As you say, he could be inconsistent, but he can be very quick on the day. And so it's really a question of where it's going to go from there.
Yeah. Now, was it? I think Jules was pointing out that he's had a shoulder injury,
mm-hmm.
and in the past, which means his shoulder's weak. So, how he's going to get on muscling a CRT MotoGP bike will be interesting to see.
It will be because you know those guys are going to have to be wrestling those things around, like the very very refined factory bikes don't necessarily have to do so. They're also going to be running through an awful lot of changes as time goes on. Those kind of things can wear on you.
Yeah. 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 Those bikes are unlikely to remain in much the same character, you know, race by race by race at the beginning. The changes are going to be huge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, massive. Huge isn't even the proper term. Earth shaking might be.
Yeah. Yeah. Nuts and bolts. I mean, what we saw Rossi and the Ducati team go through last year is probably the sort of, you know, amount of radical changes the CRT guys are going to do. In more encouraging news, Yamaha Factory MotoGP team announced that Ineos and JX Nippon Oil are to replace Petronas as a major sponsor for the coming season. They're not going to be a title sponsor. That's yet to be announced, if indeed there is one. And the team livery won't be revealed until the official launch of the second Sepang test, which is later in February. But it is encouraging news that someone's come in to replace Petronas. Now, when this news broke, there was a storm on Twitter. I believe it's known as a Twitter storm. and Wiggy-san, what a diamond, he put together a mock-up of what it might look like because the corporate colours of Ineos are orange. And mm-hmm. red.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, that'll look a bit like a Repsol then. and he put together a very, very good picture of what it might look like. And it actually looked quite funky, but it looks like they're not going to be the title sponsor. But we've all seen that Petronas have been fairly largely placed, or their name has been fairly largely placed on the M1s over the years. So expect to see Ineos replacing that. There's also been a lot of talk with and by Carmelo Ezpeleta, the CEO of Dorna SL, who are the rights owners, of course, of MotoGP. And possibly worth reminding people that their parent company, Dorna's mm-hmm. parent company, now also own World Superbikes rights. Right. So whether there's anything in that or not remains to be seen. But Carmelo's been talking about MotoGP, CRT, and the future. And basically, he said what he wants is a 21 bike grid with a minimal gap from front to rear, which is obviously quite an ambition. There was an interview in Cycle News on cyclenews.com website, and he said he's reluctant to enforce things like a control ECU or a rev limit, but he's prepared to do just that if the manufacturers can't agree on a way of limiting costs. They're looking at an agreement reached in principle that satellite bikes could be leased for 1 million euros, which is about just under $1.3 million a year. But as several of the in the team people on Twitter were pointing out, you're allowed to paint it your color and change the oil, mm-hmm. the lease bike. That the manufacturer retains a lot of control over what you can do with that bike, which I would imagine, being a cynical bit of a bloke, is if you start doing a bit too well, they can not give you upgrades or possibly even downgrade some of your equipment because they don't want you challenging their factory bikes.
I.e. when Barros beat Stoner on the Pramac bike to the podium not so many years ago.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes, there were all sorts of rumors about what exactly they did to slow that down. He's also proposing from 2013, each manufacturer will be allowed two factory bikes and two satellite bikes, similar to what we see with Yamaha. You know, you've got Tektuar and you've got the factory team. CRT will make up the remainder of the grid, although he hasn't said what would happen if Suzuki and or Kawasaki were to return as a factory effort, and Suzuki is still talking about being back in 2014, whether the CRT numbers come down to keep the grid at 21 or the total number of bikes is allowed to grow, which I think would be good. He hasn't specified, but he's obviously saying, look, we need to do something. And there's so many naysayers out there going, oh, CRT, it's going to be rubbish. It's going to be absolute pants. Good luck to those guys. Huh? What do you want? Do we want a 12-bike grid? I don't.
Nope.
Do we want people to be scoring multiple points for simply finishing the race? No, thank you. You know, if this is what it takes, then sure, at first there's going to be massive gaps. Well, of course there are. You know, they're just starting. But as the point you guys made last week or the week before, whenever it was exactly the same with Moto2. First couple of races, the purists were saying, well, they're not even as quick as World Supersport at that track. And then within a few races, well, okay, now they are as quick. And then by the end of that season, okay, now they're quicker.
Mm-hmm.
It will take it. Less encouragingly for the future, Shuhei Nakamoto, who's team principal of HRC, Honda Racing Corporation, he said last week that if the future is CRT, then HRC have no interest whatsoever in remaining involved in MotoGP. And I immediately thought, really? Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. It's just my thoughts, but I think if Yamaha, Ducati, Aprilia, particularly if Suzuki and Kawasaki come back in, I don't think Honda would feel they could afford not to be involved. That sounds like a bluff to me, just as I can't remember what the proposal was over, but Ferrari threatened to pull out F1. I don't know what the proposal was, because I don't care. But
that being said, you do have to remember, Martin, when most of the factories pulled out of World Superbike because they felt it was a Ducati cup, and that was, you know, the phrase that was going around for a while. It certainly doesn't seem that way these days to me. There's a lot of other riders that win in World Superbike, even though Carlos Checa, bless his aging heart, took the title last year. But I mean, I think that these aren't necessarily empty threats, but I think what we have to do is, this is going to be a very interesting year to see how things pan out. And it's a little bit different when you have the subclasses making a change like Moto2 or this year as well with Moto3. This is going to be one of those years where we've got a whole bunch of non-ideas on what's going to happen. And frankly, even the riders that were at Sepang, or the CRT guys that were testing at Valencia, are saying the exact same thing. We don't know. We've got no idea what's going to happen. It's clear from the times, and we'll discuss that in a very short period, that there is some disparity, but not unexpected. We figured that was going to happen because teething pains, you know, growing into it. But a little bit crazy.
I take your point about the factories pulling out World Superbike, but then it was always meant to be production bikes run by privateer teams, and they always had at the time that GP500,
mm-hmm.
And particularly, I mean, Honda are so competitive, particularly with the other Japanese manufacturers. You know, they are the biggest, not in real terms. I think that's Kawasaki, but that's because of their heavy engineering side. But in terms of bike manufacturers, Honda are massive, and I'm not sure they would feel that they could afford to pull out of motorcycling's pre-class. If indeed it's data, of course. But
sure.
More changes. of course, are also where future races to be held. And the Europeans, those of us living in the Europe, I think there's been a lot of, oh, no, no, we don't want this to happen. Well, that's because it's easy for us to travel within Europe. But I think Carmelo Ezpeleta is being very realistic, and they need to tap into new and expanding markets. So they're pushing hard for races to be held in Asia, South America, the Far East. So from 2013, it's nailed on there will not be four races in Spain. And unfortunately, I don't love the track. I love the races that the track produces, but Jerez looks most at risk. With nothing to do with how good the track is, all to do with the fact that the region is struggling to raise funds. Estoril looks under threat. Mugello's nailed on to remain, but Misano is far from certain. And there was also an article today where they were talking to Lynn Jarvis, and this was on motomatters.com with David Emmett. And although Berno is a riders and fans' favourite and packs in the crowds, the regional government in that part of the Czech Republic are not very supportive.
Right.
So we've already seen, we've got the third US race at the Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas, in 2013, plus an Argentinian round. And Ezpeleta said he expects to see rounds in India and South Korea in the near future. And if there was a suitable track, or as soon as there is a suitable track, I suspect Indonesia will be another area they go to. And it was fascinating to hear Simon Krajewar talking last week about he went to race in Malaysia. And most of the racers were Australians and Kiwis, but the locals were mad for it. So
I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Moscow Raceway in World Superbike and whether Dorna decides to also run at that circuit. Talk about a vast untapped market.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's okay. Obviously, there are time differences there, but the infrastructure is much closer to a European one than going to someone like Indonesia.
Sure.
So, you know, although, yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. I can't remember when in the World Superbike calendar that race is coming up, because weather will be another issue if they run it early or late.
Well, it's not all Siberian. Us here in the Western world have kind of probably a slightly distorted view of what the weather might be like. You know, that Argentinian round, I have that penciled in on my calendar. I want to try and get down to that. So in 2013, my plan is to hit the TT, which is a perennial favorite, obviously. Both the USGPs at Laguna and at Indy, if it still exists. Austin, I guess all three, I should say, whichever ones are still around. And then perhaps Macau.
So you're not planning to have a proper job by then?
hopefully, Martin, if we can figure it out, this will become my proper job. Once I get a decent studio set up and people stop complaining about my going on and on or my audio issues, you guys will start to love me even more.
Excellent.
Yeah. You know what we should do before we dive into talking about what was going on at Sepang? Let's at least run the Scott Redding interview, and then we'll come back and we'll chat about Sepang.
Excellent.
Hey, this is Jim Race here for Motopod with Scott Redding of the Mark VDS Moto 2 squad. How you doing, Scott?
Yeah, not doing too bad, thanks.
You're in the process of moving, so your life is probably in a bit of turmoil, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just a bit busy at the moment with training and everything like that, and then moving house as well, but it's all good.
Yeah, well, you know, timing is everything, and things are coming along. When is your first test coming up?
I'm flying out Tuesday, and I believe it's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in Valencia.
Okay.
This week.
And I think the weather should be looking good for that. I want to pull you back a little bit. You know, it was interesting last night because I asked on Twitter, and Ian, your manager and one of the gentlemen that runs your squad was one of the people that answered back, what was the best Moto2 race of 2011? And unanimously from everybody, the answer was Aragon. I want to drag you back to Aragon. Tell me your impressions about that race. That was quite the barn burner at the front.
Yeah, it was a very good race, really, for me. I had potential to be on the podium, if not to win the race, you know. But the tyre went off halfway through the race and just destroyed the tyre to pieces. And I had no grip, no feeling or nothing. I thought there was something seriously wrong. But there was nothing really I could do except try and finish the race. But the actual race was really good because we were sort of a little bit struggling through the weekend, but we was getting stronger and stronger at the same time. Once we got it there, with the beginning of the race was awesome. I was out battling with the guys and it was great.
How many passes do you think actually occurred in that race? My guess, when I was watching it back last night, must have been somewhere in the range of 100 for the lead.
Yeah, it was so many passes that every corner there was two or three people going underneath each other. Then they'd be fighting back. And the racing was good because we know whoever, if Marquez or Brad or Ian only got to the front, they could pull away.
Yeah.
So that from my attack was just to keep bombing back at them and seemed to work for the beginning. But as you see, the tires just didn't really want to cope with it.
So you guys all end up with the same tires, but a lot of it is set up, you know, depending on chassis setup and, whatever you've got available to you as the race goes on. And, of course, part of it is rider weight. To carry on with that thought, you were on a Suter chassis that was a step behind Marquez. What do you think you're going to need now that you've switched to Kalex for 2012 to run at the front consistently?
I think personally, it's just I got the fitness. I've tried to get the weight down as much as I can through the winter, but I've grown a little bit more again. When I was on the Kalex at the end of the year, it was a transformed bike from what the Suter was. You know, it was unreal with the positioning of everything on the bike. I felt a lot more comfortable. I felt not so more on the edge, so I could do the lap times consistently. Even with like a 30 lap old tire, I could still do as good lap time with a new one. So it's really good on that side and it just builds the confidence so much. And I think for the first few races, that'll be the main thing, get some confidence and rhythm.
I've heard from a few people that the Kalex actually feels like a really big 125 in the way it handles.
Yeah, you know, first when I got on it, I said it just keeps falling into the corner all the time, but also the change of direction. I was in Valencia, there's the fast left-right. I was like full gas fourth and I slung it over and I didn't realize I did it so hard. As I pulled it over, I was just doing a wheelie and, you know, I was so much effort with the Suter to change direction, but with this thing, it's just like riding a 125 with carbon wheels.
Nice. It's interesting enough, and I know that you probably as a rider stay out of the politics, but I do find it interesting that a lot of teams have migrated from the Suter chassis to Kalex this year.
Yeah, there is quite a few teams that have changed. But for us, it was just we wasn't getting what we was told we were going to get. Marquez was new into it and we was with Suter for a year and then he started getting everything. And we was actually the test rider for Suter. And he was getting more parts than we were. So we was basically getting the rough end of the stick. And it don't really cut it, you know, when you're at a level like that. Things like that can't really happen when you're struggling with weight and other things at the same time.
Are you a little bit disappointed that Marquez did not step out and go into MotoGP this year and he's going to be back again?
No, I'm actually quite glad because this year feels like I actually have a chance. Mm-hmm. Since I've got on the Kalex, I've said I've always wanted to ride this bike and it was a good decision. And I actually feel like I can be competitive now. I'm not just saying, like, you know, being positive, I can be competitive. I mean, I can be competitive. You know, I'm a lot more relaxed, doing a lot more laps and testing, and it's just so much easier. And I get the impression that's what the top guys were like when they're riding. And as a Suter is quite small, this is our reckon that Marquez is riding with it so fast.
Yeah. Well, it certainly watching Aragon back again last night, you could see that he was, the one thing that he had was he was incredibly smooth on the bike, and there was like no head shake or anything. And I was watching the rest of you guys struggle a bit, and it was clear that he had some special bits on that thing.
Yeah, definitely was. He also, with the weight, he gets a bit more top speed, but with the Kallax aerodynamics, we don't seem to be losing so much, so it's another bonus point for us.
Cool.
But really, I just can't wait to get out for the season.
Yeah, I bet. Are you doing any wind tunnel testing with them to work on their fairings?
We was going to, but I don't think there's much, not point, but at the moment everything seems to be good. We've compared the data, and I wasn't losing anything with Mika, and that's with the old fairings, which are smaller.
Yeah.
And last year we were losing 0.2 in each straight.
Okay. And so what are you doing training-wise off-season?
Been doing some downhill races, motocross, swimming, running, stuff like that, just keeping the cardio up, keeping the weight light, just doing some stuff with the trainer, and like I say, some downhill races, just have some fun.
Cool. And you did say that you dropped some weight since last year, a couple stone?
Yeah, we tried to drop a couple of kilos, which we did at the end of the year, but I seem to have spurted up again in height again, so the weight's come back, but I've got slimmer, leaner. Yeah, it's hard work trying to keep the weight down.
Well, the holidays do kind of ruin everything, don't they?
Yeah, no, when you've got dedication and you want to do something, they don't come into mind, but it's just so hard, and you keep trying all the time, and you're getting very little back.
Cool. Well, and I do understand. All right, well, listen, I appreciate you taking the time to have a quick call with us. I wish you the best of luck at the test at Valencia. Stay safe, stay quick, and I look forward to seeing what kind of lap times you can lay down, sir.
All right, thanks for giving the call.
Hey, cheers, Scott.
Cheers, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, well, big thanks to Scott for joining us. I know that he's been in the midst of a move, getting some improved domicile, hopefully for him. He didn't have internet set up yet, so I had to talk to him on his cell phone, which we've done before with Scott. We've done some crazy interviews with Scott, talking to him on his cell phone. It's been pretty funny. We obviously had two different tests that were both going on simultaneously. Valencia, and I'm not sure if we're going to talk about that too much for the CRTs, but definitely Sepang and Martin. Let's chat about that a bit. That was a very interesting couple of days.
It was. It was a three-day test. Most of the guns were there. In fact, all the big guns were there. Most of the teams were there. As you said, we had the three Aprilia CRT riders, Randy Depunier, Aleth Espargaro, and Matthias Bassini were at Valencia. And we've got some little bits from there, which we'll talk about later. But the first day at Sepang, Casey Stoner was doing his warm-up routine in the morning and pulled a muscle in his back. He did do four laps, but none of them were particularly blisteringly quick, and then he took the rest of the day off.
Actually, those weren't him. That was one of the...
Oh, no, that's right. They were test rider, weren't they?
Yep.
Even though they went down as Casey on the timesheets, but presumably because of the data loggers. Jorge Lorenzo was quickest, put in 30 laps, did a 201.657. Pedroza was second. Cal Crutchlow, third quickest. Ben Spies. Valentino Rossi was fifth. Dovi, still injured from his motocross accident, came in sixth. Hector Barbera. And then there were some test riders. Nicky Hayden, also struggling with a recovering injury. Day two, they went out. And I think it was on Casey's fourth lap, he got the quickest time of the day. He just did what he did all last year. He just went out and nailed it. He did a 2 minute dead 0.895. Ben Spies and Jorge were pretty close behind him, you know, only 0.15 of a second for Ben. Danny Cal still doing well. Hector Barbera doing very well on the Pramac Ducati. Valentino seventh. Alvaro Bautista getting to grips with the Gresini Honda. Dovi, Nicky Hayden, Stefan Bradl doing very well. Carol Abraham equally on and down. Now, Colin was having some issues on day one. Colin wasn't able to run the bike they will be racing this year. He had to run on the one they tested at the end of last year, or the sort of thrown together for NGM Mobile Ford Racing. Ivan Silva had a couple of offs. Jordi Torres and Robertino Pietri equally were a long, long way behind. I mean, Colin was 4.7 seconds off Casey. Silva was 9 seconds. Torres was nearly 11. And Pietri was 11.5.
I will point out that it was very amusing. Once again, Colin was extremely active on Twitter throughout the entire test. And I was hell of amused. And he was responding to pretty much everybody that was chatting with him. He spent a good part of the first day sitting because they were having issues with the bike. But once he got rolling, and he dropped a ton of time. And clearly, in a way, Colin is the guy that we're looking to see what the measure of the CRT bikes can be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But we saw this on day three, today, the last day. Casey broke 2 minutes, 1:59.607 during his 21 laps. And again, it came quite early because rain actually stopped play, halfway through their afternoon session. Jorge was second, but nearly 0.6 of a second behind. Danny just behind him. Ben just behind Danny. Rossi was fifth. Barbera, Crutchlow, Dovizioso, Bautista, Hayden, Bradle, Abraham, Katsuyuki Nagasuka on the Yamaha test rider, and Franco Battaini, the Catty test rider, ahead of Colin. But look at Colin's time. He's 5 seconds off Casey's now, rather than what was on the first day, 6.5.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the improvements that Colin made in time were quite significant in nearly 4 seconds over the 2 days. Silva, Pietri and Torres still struggling, 8, 10 and 10. But that improvement we saw, I mean, Colin was saying that this is day one, week one.
Yeah.
You know? Well, not just Colin, a lot of people were saying, you know, this is really early. Guys, let's not start, because there again have been, but you see people on Twitter, on the forums, and they're going, well, this is a complete waste of time.
Well, Martin, you've been listening to me do this show for ages, and you know that I say every year that testing is not racing. And trying to make a comparison between now and the real deal is difficult. That being said, I have hope, and just from this very brief venture that we've had in Sepang, the CRT boys may make an impact. As you said, you don't want them to just make up the grid and you don't want them to just make up points, but racing is racing. And part of it is actually getting to the finish line. If the bottom line is what we don't want to see, and I think everybody out there in Motopod land would actually agree about this, is we don't want to see guys getting lapped. Right now, as the times are looking, that may happen. But we know it just being, you know, let's call it day zero, if you will, that things are going to change very quickly. And I think the gap is going to continue to shrink. And I don't think I'm stepping out on a limb that we may actually see. And Martin, I will disagree with you, by the way. I think Rossi, and I've said this publicly, will win at least 2 races this year. So there you go. I put my stamp on it.
Okay.
All right.
you can keep Big John Hart awake whilst he drives that truck all the way across the Atlantic to deliver my beer.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe what we'll do is we'll have condensed episodes, and then we'll have, you know, long episodes, you know, for that transatlantic journey. I would like to mention
David Emmett at motomatters.com, after day two of the test, produced a fascinating comparison between the 2011 test times and this year's test times.
Yeah.
And the The biggest improvement was between Stefan Bradl on this year's LCR and Tony Lewis on last year's LCR. So this could be an element of rider as well as bike. That was a 1.6 second improvement. Cal Crutchlow this year.
Okay, let me pause you for a moment.
Sure. Okay, this is 1,000cc, not an 800.
Right, but I believe. Actually, you know what? Carry on. I'll come back to my point.
Okay, no. Cal Crutchlow, yeah, okay, but he's got 200 extra cc, we believe, to play with. But that's a 1.5 second improvement, which is pretty blooming impressive. Carol Abraham, 0.8, Rossi, 0.7, Stoner, 0.5. And the guys who were quickest last year, as you'd expect, have got the smaller improvements. Lorenzo, 0.5, or just under 0.5, Ben, 0.456. Barbera, 0.3. Nicky Hayden, barely at all, but then, of course, he's riding injured at the moment. Alvaro Bautista is 0.2 slower than he was on the Suzuki last year, but then he'd already had a year getting used to it.
Right.
Dovi is 0.6 slower, but then he's gone from a factory Honda to a satellite Yamaha, and he's injured. Now, Danny Pedrosa's interesting. That's a 0.7 slower from last year to this, which I found a bit curious.
It is curious because last year he started injured, and this year he was celebrating the fact that he's not injured.
And he's on a bigger bike.
Yeah.
Which this was talked about last year, wasn't it? The one or the two people that were expected to struggle or people thought could struggle were Jorge Lorenzo because of his style so suited the 250s and therefore the 800s, maintaining corner speed, you know. And he clearly hasn't. We saw that at the test at Brno last year. So he seems to love it. And Danny, because of his size. And I don't know. I mean, again, we don't want to read too much into it. The final comparison was Colin last year on the Tech Tour to this year on the CRT, which is possibly a fair comparison, 3.8 seconds. Well, I think 3.8 seconds, when he'd been on that Yamaha in either factory or satellite team, you know, in one form or another for years, that's not that bad.
No.
3.8 seconds is not that bad. And yeah, I think there's some interesting conclusions to be drawn from it, although none of them are set in stone.
I should probably give Colin a call and get his impressions from Sepang Test 1 for next week's show.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. He's on his way. He tweeted earlier, he's on his way back to the Lone Star State. I presume it's not California. They've got loads of stars there, haven't they? That's where Hollywood is. It must be Texas.
That would be Texas.
Meanwhile, as we mentioned earlier, at Valencia, the Aprilia CRTs were producing some quite interesting times. They had a 2-day test. The Pune Pessini and Espargaro, that's Aleth Espargaro, were wazzing around, and again, we're indebted to David Emmett at motormatch.com. We get all our information from David, then just pretend that we know it anyway.
he's a good friend of the show.
No, absolutely, and he's also a really, really charming chap, and if anybody, you know, if you like your statistics served up in a way that is easy to understand and really highlights those things that statistics can highlight, motormatters.com is a website to get into. And there's also some really interesting conversations take place in the forums and the comments below the articles.
Yeah, I enjoy reading the comments below the articles.
David, he tries to keep hands off, but he will get involved and moderate when, because people do get a little bit.
If what you listen to or read, I'm sorry, if what you read is crash.net and you want something a little less juvenile, just head over to motormatters.com.
Well, absolutely. And what David's done, he's made a comparison between various tests at Valencia and this CRT test. For example, his benchmark was Danny Pedrosa at the 1,000cc test after Valencia at the end of last season, and Danny did a 131.8. Randy Depugne at Valencia qualifying on the Ducati GP11 when he was at Pramac, did a 133.1, so that's a 1.3-second gap. At the 1,000cc test where Danny produced his 131, Randy on the Suzuki 800, bizarrely, testing at the 1,000cc test, he was 1.7 behind Danny's time. And in FP3 on the Ducati GP11, he was 1.9 behind. Well, at the CRT test he's just done, he was only 3 seconds. That's less, or only just, sorry, not less, just over a second slower than his FP3 time on the GP11 at the race, albeit, yeah, 200cc lower. But that is really encouraging.
It's kind of interesting that a few years back we would have never tried to use Randy DePugna as a benchmark, but his consistency...
He's the only one we've got, because the other riders, in fact, sorry, Carmelo Morales was, oh no, that's right, yeah, Carmelo Morales, they put in because he was at the 1,000cc test on the Suter BMW, and he was only 4 seconds behind Danny's time.
Yep.
Aleth Espargaró was 3.7, and Mattia Bassini 4.8. But even though I think, wow, that is looking really good. And from day one to day two, this was held early this week, Randy improved by 0.4 seconds. Aleth Espargaró and Bassini both improved by 1.1 in 24 hours.
Right.
I mean, you know, these guys have got a long way to go with these bikes. We are not seeing anywhere near their potential. So.
Okay. I agree.
I think, you know, we can say it's going to be crap. And when people are like that, I think, well, don't bother watching.
Watch it.
Go off and watch your videos of you know, of Catalina 2009 and you know, whatever you want to do. But if you're going to watch it, be positive about it. It's our sport.
True. And there's no doubt that as a race fan, you have to support our sport, especially right now, is very critical. Because obviously, as we've seen, and we've talked to riders and you guys have heard in the interviews lately, sponsorship is tough, and what that means is we need eyeballs. We need people not only paying attention to it, but attending races. That's probably one of the most important things.
Sponsorship is advertising.
Yeah.
And if no one's looking, there's no point.
Yeah. Imagine if it went away. What would we do, Martin? Would we have a knitting show?
But this is like that, you know, oh, I'm really anti-CRT. Okay, well, are you going to have a whip around your mates and fund Kawasaki and Suzuki to come back in? Because otherwise you're going to end up with a 12-bike grid, and that's not a race.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a parade lap.
Yeah, no, very true. Before we head into some additional stuff, what I'd like to do is, and I haven't heard these except for one of them so far, once again, Phil Hall did some interviews for us down at Phillip Island for the Classics race, and I think this would be a perfect place to throw them in. What do you think, Martin?
Absolutely.
All right, let's roll it.
Okay, this is Jules, and I'm here with Edwin Hazer, long-time listener to the show, and recently returned from Australia, Phillip Island, which he has just told me is there's only one track now that he has nothing else anymore. So let's go back to how this whole thing happened, because it happened really quickly. I think it wasn't until December that you even knew you were going, right?
We went to a track day, and I've been messaging back and forth with a guy in Australia on Facebook, just kind of shooting the shit, and posted this little video, and he chimed in, and all of a sudden he goes, if you ever want to come down here, I'll lend you a bike. And then 2 comments later, all of a sudden he's offering a place to stay, and I'm going, you know, is this for real, or, you know, so I had...
Who's the guy?
The guy's Roger Gunn.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know him, you know, other than messaging back and forth.
Right.
So I was a little skeptical for about 5 seconds. And I... that's just another guy that I know that I've been going back and forth with in Australia that's building a bike kind of like mine. And I've sent him some carburetors, and he knows a lot of people in the racing scene. So I messaged him saying, hey, like, can you find out who this guy is and if this guy is, you know, for real? Because he offered me this deal, and I just, you know, before I'm going to go fly all the way down under, you know, and spend a bunch of money getting there, I need to know what I'm getting myself into. So he came back within, I don't know, 20 minutes. Said, no, this guy's for real. Check all checks out and just go for it. So I messaged him back. You know, at the time, I didn't know if I could make it work financially because it's not cheap to, like, cut out. I'd work myself, so I had to basically lose, you know, a little over a week's worth of work and then pay for the flight and staying down there. So, but it all worked out. I sold one of my bikes. And
so you went to Sydney, you flew up to Sydney, and then you immediately flew over to Melbourne, right?
Yeah, we flew
like Circuit.
Well, I got my buddy James McKay, I got him a ride. The guy had three bikes. He offered up two.
Right.
One bike for me. I could take one of two bikes.
Yeah.
And then James was jumping the gun on trying to get over there, too. So he asked me to ask him if he knew about other bikes available, but I didn't want to kind of, you know, go over the limit and ask him for another bike.
So you guys actually had, like, a Team USA going over there.
So I kind of, in a roundabout way, I said, you know, do you know of any other bikes available for Jimmy Mac? And he came back with, he can ride whichever one you don't pick.
Wow.
So James's girlfriend works for the airlines, so we were both flying on standby.
Oh, okay.
You know, we were trying to get there as cheap as possible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the deal was, you know, I'll have to fly standby, so if there's no spot, you don't get on. So I was working on Friday. I was supposed to leave on Saturday, and on Friday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I've just wrapped up the job I was working on. I'm just loading on my tools. James texts me, like, try to get on the flight tonight instead of tomorrow.
I remember that. Yeah.
So I'm, like, hustling home. I hadn't packed a thing yet. So I ran home. Luckily, I'd made a list of everything I wanted to take with me, but I hadn't packed anything since I thought I'd had another day and a half.
Oh, my God.
So I stuffed everything in the bags, ended up going to the airport, got on the flight because there was a lot of people missing flights, the connecting flight in San Francisco, because in the Midwest, the snow was happening.
Right, right.
So he said, you know, if you don't get on tonight, likelihood of Saturday is going to be zero.
Right, right.
So
right.
I ended up getting out. He ended up getting stuck on Saturday himself because he can get on.
Shit.
He didn't get on until Sunday night. So it worked out perfect. So then got there, called up Roger, like, hey, I'm already here. A day early.
You were in Sydney.
Well, I flew to Sydney. Then ended up
there. Jumper?
Then an hour and a half later, so jumped on the flight to Melbourne.
Okay.
And then called Roger.
You basically, you went with a double bag worth of stuff, leathers.
One bag with all my gear. You know, the leathers, the helmet, the boots, gloves, all that stuff. And another bag for my clothing, and that's it.
Nice, nice. And then you got to Melbourne.
And money.
You drove out there.
He picked me up. He drove me to this one incredible shop, this guy T-Rex.
Oh, yeah, he's got a first stop.
That's all he does is make bikes look like insane beautiful and make them work, go fast for, you know, up to the mid-80s era or older. And so he goes, like, I got a little surprise for you. So we stopped by that shop straight from the airport on a Sunday. They were fucking working in there because it was like a week prior to the weekend. And then we went to the warehouse where he stores, where Roger stores his bikes.
Yeah.
And ended up hanging out there with the guy Peter that does all the wrenching for him until, I don't know, 12 o'clock at night. We stayed there quite long.
What was the beverage of choice?
Well, that evening it was rum and cola. It's called Bundaberg.
Okay.
In cans. That's all Peter drinks. So that's all he had there. So that's what I was drinking. I usually drink beer, but, you know, whatever he had, you know, we'll do.
Cool.
Liquid dinner.
Yep. All right. Impressions of arriving at Phillip Island?
Intimidating.
You came in the morning, right?
Yeah, we went to do a track day on Thursday.
Yep.
And the first time out, I pretty much already found the very deepest brake marker in turn four. Because Jimmy and Roger were ahead of me on the corner. Yeah. And I went in there, and I'm going, oh, I'm supposed to go over there. And I just, you know, I had to go on the brakes really hard. Almost ran off the track.
Well, hang on. So right away, you were were on that same, but that bike that you chose. You chose
a chose a 1982 Katana, exactly the same as Roger's, only Roger's has got more horsepower. Mine had about 120, I think his is like close to 150.
Wow, how do you get that? What do you do to that thing?
Just bore them out and pump them up and do a good head job. And, you know, it's not that hard. It's just a little bit tricky to make them reliable.
You think the yellow is faster than the Katana gray?
It startles people, I think.
Oh, I know, definitely. There's some great color scheme. I both like both the yellow and red and the yellow-blue kind of thing. We'll link to some of those images. And, well, I think a lot of listeners already follow you anyway. But, all right, so, yes, you get out on the track. I mean, you must have had, like, that, holy shit, I'm in fucking Phillip Island when you go over towards Dunes.
I had looked at YouTube videos. Yeah. Well, I should have looked a whole lot more, and I should have studied the track map a whole lot more. I pretty much went out there not knowing shit.
Right.
And I totally did not know where the track was going. You know, there's so many blind crests there, and you don't know how long the turn keeps going.
Right.
Until you've done it a few times over. So the first session was definitely intimidating. I thought it was a little bit in over my head. And then the second time, it was like 100% better. And then we really started going pretty good. Towards the end of the day, we were feeling pretty comfortable. We weren't quite doing the lap times we wanted to do yet, but
yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah. What's the plunge like from Lukey Heights?
Lukey Heights, not too bad.
Not too bad, is it?
Yeah,
comparable to the corkscrew in terms of
coming out of Lukey Heights, going down to into MG?
Yeah.
No, it's short. It's kind of I kind of compare it coming out of at Thunder Hill, coming out of the Cyclone, making the right-hander. It's about that distance.
It's, got it. Well, it's really short, though.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you're coming out really wide. You know, you're coming out at a lot higher speed than the Cyclone.
Right. Nice.
But that's definitely one of my favorite turns there.
What about the fast last corner? That last corner sounds...
Coming under the front straight?
Yeah. Oh, that's so
bike,
fun.
That bike is bucking and weaving and trying to spit you off, and you keep on the gas, and it's fun. Hanging above the curbing there, you know, totally hanging off the bike there, with your knee on the curbing is just insane fun.
Do you stay on the outside mostly there?
In the last turn?
Yeah.
No, I tried to cut it almost on the checkered curbing.
On the inside curbing?
On the left-hand side coming out of the front side. Right, but the bike grips so wide that on Friday, I almost ran into the gravel trap. I went into the grass big time. I was like 2 feet away from the gravel trap.
Oh, my God.
Guys in the pits were all going, oh, shit, he's going off. But I managed to pull it back on track, and that kind of spooked me.
I kind of
let off, and that made me run off track. I should have just kept it on and just kind of looked where I needed to go.
Well, so wait, we need to go back, which is that this was a race weekend for some. It was called the Classic Island Classic.
Yeah, it's the third biggest race weekend in Australia besides MotoGP and World Superbike.
Yep.
They had something. I think they had 19,400 spectators over the 3 days.
Wow.
So not bad.
Not bad at all. And you were running in what group was like
our group is called P5, and they call it Forgotten Era Superbike.
Forgotten Era, that's right. Which
was the most popular. It's like the main class running that weekend.
What else is running in there besides like
a lot of Katanas, CBX six cylinder? Is one guy out there doing pretty good?
Six cylinder.
Oh yeah, doing 47s on that thing.
Wow,
1:47. So lots of KZ1000s or Z1000s. I don't know what they call them there.
Mm-hmm.
Honda CB750s or 900s, I'm not sure what they run there. Could be even CB1100s. And those XR69 Suzukis are just pieces of art. But, you know, they were like Robbie Phillips and a bunch of other guys, they were kind of complaining about them because those bikes are like $250,000 to put together. There's stuff on there, like the front Brembo brakes, they didn't have that in those days.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of pushing the rules a little bit, and people are getting a little ticked off about it.
What are the rules for that class?
Well, it has to be kind of the period look of that era. And, you know, like they're putting stuff on it, kind of like I've done with some of the stuff on my bike here. You know, it's not really, you know, from that period.
No. Okay, and then so you entered four races?
We did eight races.
Eight races?
Four each day. Four on Saturday, four on Sunday. Normally, you either run the International Challenge, which is four races, two Saturday, two Sunday, but they allowed us, since it was our first time out there, to also run the Australian class, which pretty much had Australians only in it.
Cool.
And, there was extra track time, so we'll take whatever we get.
Great. And you were you on the track at the same time as like McWilliams and those guys?
Oh yeah. They come barreling past you with those bikes like you're standing still.
Yeah.
I mean they just disappear down front straight, like in no time. They were doing I want to say 38. 1 minute 38 seconds.
And what was your best lap 42s?
My best lap was a 48.9.
A 48. So yeah. Because I know you were shooting for high 40s or something like that.
Yeah, I was hoping I was going to get to a 46, but I had never ridden the bike. I didn't know how good the bike was.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was probably a little bit of a tall order.
So I saw.
But I think with a little bit more track time, I can definitely get in the 47s.
Nice. I saw the standings, and you guys kicked some fucking ass.
In the Australian, in the Forgotten Era Superbike class, I ended the fifth overall.
Yeah.
So not too bad.
Very consistent. Very consistent. And then, there were a couple guys who I think finished in front of you, but they crashed at least one race. Or
Yeah. There were some 0 point finishes there. Consistency pays off.
So what was the point scoring like? Because there were some 15s, which was kind of a strange number.
Who cares? Yeah, I don't care. I'll take it.
The Team USA did pretty good. And you had great weather the entire time, right?
Perfect weather every day.
It
was 55 degrees on Sunday.
Wow.
So it was good.
We're talking Celsius here.
Yeah, Celsius.
And then I know it started raining as soon as you left, which is like actually the
torrential
perfect way to go.
Downpour, unbelievably. We lucked out big time. Yeah. I mean,
there's photos of you appearing on various websites now. I saw one on Flickr, just random. Some guy was shooting at the Island Classic, and I was like,
you come over, look at your eyes, there's like five guys standing there just snapping away. It's just insane.
Yeah, because I saw that the. MC.
He ended up staying at the house we were staying in. He ended up crashing there. I guess Roger Gunn knows the guy. He's a young kid, but he takes pretty good pictures. Had somehow organized to take pictures on the front straight at the end of Saturday. So
that's cool.
Very cool experience.
So why did you come back?
Well, I don't know.
I guess your
family.
Bring the family over next time. Then you'll stay.
I'm definitely going back.
It's an amazing adventure. I love the fact that it came together so fast and you just jumped on it.
Well, I was initially didn't think I had the money to do it. And then I'm going, if I don't do it now, maybe next year he doesn't offer it.
Right.
So I got to
just
jump on it and somehow make it work, And if you focus, I think, you can make things work for you.
They adopted you into the family pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. The whole crowd there was super friendly.
Yeah,
really cool. Met lots of cool people.
And you brought back a lot of audio content, which we'll play later in the show. So
I just gave him the little recording device I had, and he knows all those guys.
Cool.
So he just had, I wouldn't be able to interview those people, I don't know how to do it. So I said, why don't you, here's the recorder, go for it, get as many as possible.
And you also pretty much have video from every single time on the track?
Every single session, except for the second session we did on the track day. I forgot to turn it on, which would have been fun because I was sticking it on the outside on the striped curbing going into turn one next to James McKay.
Oh, really? Nice.
They were saying there's two perpendicular stripes close together, and then they're a little bit further, deeper into it. There's a single one there, and Roger Gunn said, if you guys can get close to that first one, you guys are going to be doing pretty good. And we were well past it, and we're still side by side going into it.
Excellent.
We're just laughing at each other, just having fun.
And then, of course, at the last race, you had a crash in Honda, and you're a little bit banged up. You said you might have a couple broken ribs.
Yeah, well, I was trying to kind of play it off like it was not that big a deal in the medical facility because I wanted to be able to get back on the flight.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go to the doctor this morning and see what's really up. I know for sure I have some broken ribs.
Ouch.
From last time, but you know.
You got the full experience. The full experience.
Yeah.
At Phillip Island. And now
it's back to reality.
How the hell are you going to, you know, build a track there at Thunder Hill?
Ride a lot harder.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, dude.
All right, man.
This is Phil Hall on location again at Phillip Island International Grand Prix Circuit for the running of the 19th annual Phillip Island Classic, and I'm here with international rider Jeremy McWilliams. Jeremy, welcome to Phillip Island, but this is not your first time riding here at Phillip Island.
No, I think it's my 15th or 16th possibly. I've quite lost count now, but to be honest with you, but yeah, it's a circuit I love. Good to be back. Hasn't changed much. It's exactly as I remember it when I was racing GP.
But a different sort of bike.
Well, that's changed quite a bit, yeah. Yeah, it's it takes a certain sort of style to ride the bike. It's an old Harris F1. And it's getting around here pretty well, but, you know, you've got to adapt your style, you've got to change everything, and yeah, you've just basically got to just be really smooth with it, not really like you ride a Grand Prix bike or a modern era bike anyway.
So what is the bike like? Is it, you know, did it surprise you at how good it is?
Really surprised me last year. I was taken back really by the lap times that we were getting around, and I think that's obviously part to do with, you know, the tire development. You know, they weren't running tires like these back in the day, but I'm on the new Bridgestone and going very, very well on it here straight out of the box. I think we're all surprised just how well they get round. They are big motors, but they're a big old heavy lump.
But there's a certain attraction to the sound that you get from this that you don't get from a modern bike. They sound beefier, you know?
Well, yeah, these Formula One bikes sound real well. I think this is about a 1,240cc or something. Pretty much, you know, it's quite a raw, oil-cooled old bike, and it's physically it sounds great down the straight. Maximum RPM about 10 and a bit, 10 and a quarter or so. But they're still getting on a fair old lick. I don't really know what horsepower they're making, possibly upwards of 150 horsepower.
And why do they run on a treaded tire rather than a slick? That's fascinated me.
Well, good question. We can run on a slick if we so wish, but it just so happens that new generation Super Sport tire happens to be working pretty well. The R10 is on the Bridgestone, I think. It's an N-Tech on a Dunlop. And, Pirelli have one as well. Some of the guys are running slicks, but I don't really think there's a big advantage to the slick. This tire comes up to temperature pretty good. And, as I say, you know, that new generation Super Sport tire is pretty awesome right now.
Jeremy, you've sort of pretty much been there and done just about everything there is to do. Grand Prix and 250s and MotoGP and 500cc. And, you know, you've done pretty much everything, you know, in your career. What's the attraction of this type of racing?
Well, we had to come out and spend a week in Phillip Island. Have a bit of fun with the boys. We got a team here, you know, it's Team GP, and we want to come and win it, obviously, so there's many reasons, but it's very, very... It's an easy call whenever you get asked to come and do it with the expenses paid. I mean, it wasn't a difficult choice.
Come out here in the sunshine instead of freezing.
Absolutely.
Freezing nuts off,
yeah.
In the UK.
Well, I was going to say that. That's exactly what it is, really. It's you know, I prefer to spend more time here, but I'm pretty busy at home. I've got to get back home again. I'd love to spend a couple of weeks here. Love the island. Love the circuit. Like the people. We all seem to get on pretty well, and I'll be back again.
And the laid-back sort of, the more laid-back sort of atmosphere, I guess, is an attraction too?
Well, I think, as you well know, you know, the Irish and the Aussies seem to get on pretty well. Maybe it's a typical sort of similar outlook to life, but yeah, we all like a beer as well. That's what I'm really saying. And we get to do that when the racing's all finished. So, I mean, it couldn't be better. As long as it doesn't rain, it doesn't seem like it's going to rain here. We'll have a great weekend, and everybody's enjoying it, as you can tell. The atmosphere is brilliant.
Jeremy, thank you so much for your time. I know you're busy, and I really appreciate you sparing me a few minutes. Thank you very much.
No worries, man.
Ryan, we're fortunate here in Australia that we get to see a lot of the true road racing stuff on Speed TV here. And as a non-racing rider myself, I must admit it absolutely terrifies me. What is it actually like?
Until you actually do it, it's very hard to, explain what it's like. There's a lot of people say we're crazy, we're mad, but the buzz you get from, riding a motorcycle on a public road, the road is closed, obviously, but the buzz you get from that, you can't get it from a short circuit. As much as I love coming to Phillip Island, it's a fantastic circuit, and the people make us very welcome, and I really enjoy it. You don't get the same buzz as you would get from doing the likes of the Isle of Man TT or the Northwest 200 or the Ulster Grand Prix, just proper circuits, but it is a unique sport, and like I say, people do think we're crazy.
And it's very specialised, isn't it?
There's no doubt about that. The bike setup's different, because of the bumps and stuff compared to any other, discipline motorcycling, but there is some, quite a few road race specialists. It's a different type of riding compared to what, the Grand Prix riders and that, on a road race you just can't afford to crash. If you crash, you're going to get very seriously hurt or, even worse than that. But all the riders know the dangers, and I think that's what makes the buzz all the more exciting is the danger aspect of road racing.
And I don't know whether you caught up with it overnight, but overnight Keith Amore announced his retirement.
I'd heard rumours that for a while now, Keith, there's a couple of things going on in his life. He's got engaged, and his girlfriend, they're expecting a baby, and he had hurt himself at the Isle of Man TT last year and had to get a couple operations done on his shoulders. But I wish Keith all the best. He's one of the toughest competitors ever I've raced again on the national scene, and we've had some really good ding-dongs over the past few years, and the sport is going to be the poorer without him. But maybe in the future, whenever he gets healed up again, he'll maybe decide to give it another go. Once it's in your blood, it's very hard getting away from it. But whatever Keith decides to do, just wish him all the best.
Well, he's a noted hard man, isn't he?
He definitely is. He's a wee terrier. He'll never give up. Just, fights to the very end of, every race. And some of the toughest races I've had has been with Keith, and there's some great memories there. But, he's one of the lucky ones that has got away from the sport. He's, he lives on to tell the tale. There's a lot of friends I've met over the years, aren't that lucky. And like I say, just every rider thinks that, it'll never happen to them.
So, Ryan, apart from the obvious attraction of getting out to be here in the sun instead of freezing your tail off in Great Britain and in the middle of the northern winter, what's the attraction of coming here?
It's like a working holiday. Once we're here, it is hard work getting the bikes not ready and just getting everyone into place, do as well in the race as we can. But the people, they make us so welcome. The hospitality is fantastic. At night we chill out, try and eat good food and drink good wine and just relax as best we can. The one thing I don't like about coming out here is the length of time we'll have to sit in the airplane, but it's just one of those things, you just have to blank it out. But once we land in Melbourne, everybody makes us so welcome, we'll have a fantastic time.
Yeah, they put the south too far south, didn't they?
Well, it's just, it's a 24-hour journey for us and you just have to accept that. But this is my fourth winter coming out to Australia, and every time I've been here it has been fantastic, and hopefully it'll continue long into the future. Maybe if I happen to knock racing, competitive racing on the head at home, that I'll still be asked to come back here and have a great time.
I'd say that's highly likely. And you're talking about hard work, I can see how hard it is, because every time you come in after your session, you sit down here, you take your helmet off and you've got a great big smile on your face. I can see how hard it is.
It is. Definitely, for short circuit racing, it's one of the best short circuits I've ever done. you know, just yesterday, you know, had quite a bit of work to do with the setup of the bike, but the bike's pretty near sorted now, so hopefully that's the end of the hard work, and it's just a matter of getting your head in the gear and trying to get a good start in the race as possible, and do as well for the you know, former sponsors and the rest of the lads in the British team, and give you Aussies as good a run for your money as possible.
So what's 2012 hold for you, Ryan? What's the plans?
Pretty much the same as what I've done this past few years. I run my own team now. I've got a couple of riders of a newcomer to road racing. Jamie Hamilton's his name. He's only 21 year old. He wants to go road racing, so I'm helping him out with a 650 Super Twin and a ZX10 Superstock bike. And my teammate here, Jeremy McWilliams, is making his debut at the Northwest 200 and one of my bikes. So it's something that, you know, I'm really excited about having Jeremy on board. You know, all my sponsors are really happy, and hopefully, you know, the weather's good and Jeremy, you know, comes to the Northwest and has a fantastic time.
It seems so funny to think of Jeremy McWilliams with all the things that he's done in his career, and he's never raced the Northwest 200.
I think Jeremy has always been a fan of the Northwest, but just with other commitments and the Grand Prix day, you know, days, it just never worked out for him, where the 650 that he's riding, it's, you know, they're so easy to ride, you know, they've only 90 odd brake horsepower, and you know, the class is growing all the time. I think at the Northwest it will be quite a competitive race, so that's where my heart lies. You know, I've spent a lot of time and money developing the bike and trying to promote the class as best I can, and we've got it now to the Northwest 200 and the Isle of Man TT, so hopefully from here in it'll go from strength to strength.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for sparing us your time. I know that you've been very busy, and I really appreciate you sparing the time to talk to us. Wish you all the best, and the international team all the best, but not all of the best, because I'd still like to see the Aussies win.
Aye, fair play. You know, just hopefully everybody will have a safe, enjoyable weekend and have a few beers on Sunday night and chill out and just talk about the races. But just thanks everybody that has helped us and made it possible to get here, and hopefully we'll be back again next year for more fun.
International rider Ryan Farquhar, talking for MotoG Pod broadcast. Thank you. Okay, we're here at Phillip Island for the running of the 19th Phillip Island Island Classic in Melbourne, Australia. And this is Phil Hall, and I'm talking to Josh Brooks, international Australian rider. Josh, welcome to the program, and thanks for sparing us the time. I know you're busy.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad to be here at the event. It's the first time I've been invited to the event, and I mean, I'm excited to see how it all pans out.
And Josh, this is a bit of a surprise for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a last-minute thing. I got a call up, asked me if I'd be interested to ride. And I know about the event, but I've never actually been here to see it or take part in it. And they said, you know, that Cam Donald had been injured, and you know, they needed someone at last minute to fill the space. And they thought I'd be the best replacement. So I jumped at the opportunity to get back on a motorbike. It's been over 3 months since the last time I raced in BSB, so the off season feels like it's a very long time off a motorbike. So I thought it's a good opportunity to get back on a racetrack and have a bit of fun and enjoy it.
And on a track that you love.
Yeah, Phillip Island's one of my favourites, and I mean, I don't get to ride at home much anymore because all my racing goes on over in the British Championship. So being here at Phillip Island's you know, a bit of a reward as well.
Tell us about the bike you're riding, Josh.
Well, I mean, I don't know much about it. There's quite a lot of history here at this event, and I mean, the bike I've got's a Harris Frame GSX 1100, and you know, 81 model. And I mean, I was born in 83, so there's a lot of history, like I said, around this event, and there's a lot of stuff for me to learn about this bike. At the moment, I've only had a couple of runs on it, and it's a very foreign, you know, compared with what I'm used to riding on, but I'm having fun all the same.
Just give us, for the benefit of the majority of listeners to this program, of course, will be in the United States of America, just give us a quick précis of your racing career.
Ah, okay, well, I started out racing motocross for about 10 years, and then went over and started road racing at in the Australian Championship in 2000 on a 125, and then 2001 won Australian Supersport, 2002 got second in Australian Superbike, and 2003 and 2004 was showered with injuries. 2005 I won Australian Supersport and Australian Superbike in the same year. 2006 was my first year overseas racing in World Superbikes. And then 2007, 2008 was back in World Supersport again. 2008 I finished third in the World Supersport Championship. 2009 I moved across to British Championship to try and, you know, expand my career because I was tending to always fall into a low-paid, low-ranked Supersport teams in the World Championship and wasn't ever a chance of getting a... It didn't seem like a factory ride in World Superbike, so I went and took a factory ride in British Superbikes and rode for Honda in 2009 and 2010. And then last season, I made a switch to Suzuki. And I finished fifth in the championship, but re-signed again for the same team, so running again for the TAS Suzuki team. And hopefully this year will be the one that we get the opportunity to win the British Championship.
What's life like on the road when you're racing a long way away from home? Do you sort of still regard Australia home and you know that you're an expatriate rider, or sort of you feel like sort of you belong there more than here now?
I spend more time there than I spend here in Australia, but I mean Australia is always going to be my home. It's I mean I get homesick during the year, and I mean I miss my family and friends and stuff like that, but I love what I'm doing. I wouldn't change it for the world. So, you know, I find I'm starting to see, you know, Europe as more of a home because I spend so much time there. But Australia is always going to be the number one place.
What do you think the future holds? You know, how long do you want to keep doing this? So, you know, have you got any other sort of things that you're interested in doing? Maybe sort of shifting the focus to something like, you know, World Endurance or something like that, like Steve Martin and Warwick Nowland have done, or does your heart still belong with the sprint races?
I've got an interest to ride in the TT. Everyone tries to convince me not to do it, but I mean, some people, you know, go skydiving, some people do bungee jumping, and I'd never do those things, but I want to have a go at the TT. But I mean, that's not something I want to do with my career. That's just one thing I'd like to have done in my life. So I mean, I've got years to let that become reality. But I mean, my focus in my career and what I want to do in the future is only around motorbikes. And I mean, my ultimate goal is to get into MotoGP. I'm not going to stop giving up the dream, and I mean, I'll race. And I mean, world champions have been, you know, Bayless, Biaggi, and Checker. I mean, they're all in their 40s. I mean, when they've been world champions. So, I mean, at 28, I've still got, you know, if they're world champions at 40, I've still got 12 years to go. So, I mean, a lot can happen in 12 years. So, I mean, I've still got my goal set really high. And, I mean, I'd love to win the British Superbike Championship this year and then hopefully move across to World Superbike for a couple of years. And if I could win that and move on to MotoGP, then, I mean, that'd be my lifetime goal is to be a rider in MotoGP. So I'm going to keep pursuing that dream.
We get to see some of the British Superbike on cable TV here. The racing is incredibly intense in the British Superbike. They're really crazy guys, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're crazy, but I mean, everyone wants to win, and I think it's the same as every championship. At the top, it's tough, and I think the British Superbike in the last couple of years has gotten stronger and stronger. And I mean, this year I think we had 7 different race winners. So I mean, That's a lot of different riders are capable of winning a race, and they're all, you know, and a lot of them are international standards. So, I mean, it's almost as good as a world championship. And this year we're going to Assen. One of our rounds is going international outside of the UK, and we're going to be racing at Assen. So I'm so excited to be back on an international circuit, and yeah, really looking forward to it.
And you'll have a bit of an advantage there because a lot of the guys who do racing against won't have ridden at Assen, but you have.
Yeah, I think anyone at the level that I'm racing at, you know, can learn tracks in time to, you know, in a weekend enough to, if they've got the ability, and I mean, they've got talent like everyone I'm racing against has. I mean, one weekend you could learn enough about a track to win on it. But definitely having 3 years in the World Championship and racing 3 years at Assen is a bit of a, I'm hoping is maybe going to be a bit of an advantage for me.
What about the tracks in Britain? Josh, we see them here and we think they're such tiny little things. They're really narrow and, you know, like the mountain at Cadwell Park and stuff like that. That famous photograph of yours that you know, is spread all over the internet of you, you know, with the bike off the ground going up over the top of the mountain at Cadwell Park. Some of those tracks look incredibly daunting.
Yeah, they are. It was one of the things years ago I had an opportunity to go to BSB and I turned away from it because I didn't really like the idea of racing on the British circuits. But, I mean, I've ridden there so many years now that it's just seems natural to be on these tracks now. And I mean, they are quite small and nadgery, and I it's not something I'm really a big fan of. I mean, I much prefer the longer circuits, like Silverstone's my favourite track of the year, and then Thruxton's one of the fastest circuits of the season. I like that track, and then Donington because it's an international size circuit. That's another one of my favourites. But and then going to Aston, as I've already said, is exciting to me because it's a proper size circuit. So, I mean, that's what I prefer to ride. But at the same time, the crowd and the people that come to watch the bikes and the guys that are actually buying motorcycles and keeping us in jobs love watching the racing that happens on these smaller circuits. So, I mean, whilst it's feeding the championship and the sport, you know, we've got to keep riding on these types of circuits because the crowds just love it, and I think it does put on good racing.
And the British spectators are passionate, aren't they?
Yeah, they definitely are. Like, I remember we had like 45,000 spectators to Alton Park at the last round the year before last, and I come home and the weekend after I come down to Phillip Island for the MotoGP, and we only had like 30,000 here, and I was like, hold on a second, we had 45,000 people jammed into little old Alton Park, and the place was packed. And now you come here to Phillip Island, they're all spread out over this massive circuit, and it feels like there's no one here. So, I mean, the British public and fans are, you know, really passionate about racing. And I mean, even when it's raining, they're all there, stood by the fence, cheering you on. So it's a good championship to be involved with.
I remember a mate of mine went to the race of the year at Alton Park in 1980. He said there's about 40,000 British spectators. They're standing there in the pouring rain with their bell staffs on and their helmets on the ground at their feet, getting soaking wet.
Yeah, no, we've had the same situations there at Knock Hill up in Scotland 2 years in a row. So, I mean, the rain pours and they just keep driving in through the gate. They're very, very passionate.
That's good. Well, Josh, I wish you all the best this weekend and for 2012 in the British Superbike Championship. Having watched your racing from way back in the ADCC Moriwaki days, I sort of have a vested interest in following what you're doing, and it's been a real thrill for me to see how you've progressed through. And it's great to have you back here in Australia enjoying the sunshine. It's a glorious weather here at Phillip Island, certainly different from the rain at Knock Hill. And I hope you have a great weekend. Thank you for sparing us the time to talk.
No, it's a pleasure. I look forward to getting out and having a race with some of the, you know, the guys I've looked up to, like Stevie Martin and McWilliams and that I'm going to be racing against. So I think it'll be a great weekend. I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you. Okay, we're at Phillip Island in Melbourne, Australia, for the running of the annual Island Classic. And I've got Yamaha Austria Racing Team team rider in the Endurance World Championship, Steve Martin. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
And you're racing this weekend in a bike that's a little different to what you usually race.
Yeah, it started life as a 1982 model Suzuki Katana, and it's a bike that I've had passion with for many years. It's the first road bike I ever crashed when I was 15, and you know, I've got the opportunity to race one once a year at Phillip Island, so I couldn't turn it down.
And of course, you probably wouldn't want to turn down an opportunity to race at Phillip Island anyway.
No, I mean, it's a fantastic track. I mean, I've ridden on a lot of tracks around the world, and it's certainly one to put on your list of tracks to ride around, that's for sure.
So what are the plans for this year, Steve?
Pretty much I'm hopefully going to keep on doing everything that I did last year, which was the World Endurance again. That's all confirmed. On that front, we're probably going to have a bit more help from Yamaha this year, which will mean we'll be a little bit more competitive against the BMW and Suzuki teams, which will be good. Top of that, still be doing some test riding for BMW Superbike team on the Superbike of Marco Melandri and Leon Haslam. of course, the commentary, which I still do. I don't know if you know about that, but I do.
I do. We get it here.
Good. I do the commentary on Speed TV. Write for Two Wheels magazine. So I do a column in Two Wheels every month. And on top of that, to look after my family.
Yeah, I was wondering when you were going to get to that, because the list was getting pretty long there.
Yeah, well, they're my number one. Everything else is tacked on after that. I've done that list the wrong way around, really.
That's okay, we understand. Steve, I've always been, I've said to you off microphone, I've always been fascinated by endurance racing since way back in the Gaudier and Junot days back in the 1970s. But you know, what is the attraction for you with endurance racing as opposed to superbike racing, Grand Prix racing, all that sort of thing?
Well, it's a funny story, really. With me, the attraction, I didn't even know I had the attraction. I started racing endurance by mistake, in reality. I did do a couple of Suzuka 8 hours many, many years ago, which I've forgotten about, so that doesn't count. And then I did one in 2004, but never thought anything of it. But then in the end of 2007, when I pretty much had decided I was going to stop World Superbike racing because I couldn't get a competitive ride and I was sick of, you know, busting my guts for finishing nowhere. This guy called Mandy Kynes, who's the team manager of Yamaha Austria Racing Team, had been on at me for 4 years to try and, you know, do a ride. So I agreed to do one race with him, and that was going to be my last race, and I was going to stop racing. I did the race, which was a 24-hour race at Oschersleben, and I absolutely loved it. And the thing that I loved about it was the fact that you're not on your own. When you start a sprint race, you get out there, you're on your own, your mechanic gives you a pat on the back, and then it's up to you. Endurance is really a team sport, and I guess that's something that I've missed in my superbike career, as a team sport. And what I mean by that is, if a mechanic stuffs up in the middle of the race, you can lose the race. If your teammate stuffs up in the middle of the race, you can lose the race. It's everybody's reliant on everybody, and you know, the guy fitting the tyres is just as important as the guy doing the laps.
But also, conversely, endurance racing is different because you can have a big off, get the bike back to the pits, the guys can fall on it and rebuild it, and you can still end up getting on the podium.
Yep, that's exactly right, and that's happened a few times in our, you know, time at Yacht. More often than not, you end up having a crash in the race and have to rebuild it. You'd be surprised how quickly they can rebuild those bikes. It doesn't take them long at all to, you know, everything's quick release. Everything comes off in sub-assembly. And they're also pretty tough as well. So if you do crash them, pretty, you know, 9 times out of 10, you can pick them up and get them back to the pits.
So what would be the comparison of an endurance bike? I mean, they're obviously all based on existing four-cylinder Japanese and German bikes in the case of the BMW. And, you know, for a layman like me, they look exactly the same. But they are built tougher, aren't they? What do they do to make them more crash-proof?
Well, things like foot pegs, for example, they'll make them, over the years, they know how big they have to make them and what material to make them out of, so they don't break. They just bend when you fall over. Same with levers. You know, you've got levers with tipped ends and stuff like that. Handlebars again is another one that they have solid handlebars. Everything's just made heavier, made more like a you can crash them pretty much like you can crash a dirt bike. It's hard to believe, you know, you scratch the fairing a bit, but even, you know, the fairing panels, they fall off, they just stick some new ones on. You know, to change the headlights takes 2 seconds. They just take the whole front fairing off, put a new front fairing on.
And what about wheel changes, tyre changes, Steve? What do they do to the bikes to make that easier and quicker?
Well, there's a lot of different things. For example, on our bike, we run the sprocket actually stays on the swing arm. The sprocket and the chain stays on the swing arm. You have like two U-cups. If you imagine, and you drop the wheel into these big U cups, half semicircles, the wheel drops in and out of that. So it's not a matter of lining anything up. The wheel just drops into like a cradle. It's part of the bike, and the axle just goes straight in. And on the front, it's the same thing. Brake calipers the brake pads are held back by magnets, so they don't, you know, one of the biggest problems in the front wheel is that you take your front wheel out and the pads all pads go together. On this, we don't have that problem, and everything's just spring aligned, and setting the bike up is, you know, for these quick changes is part of the thing. I mean, it takes us 10 seconds to change the wheels and do the fuels. Not much time at all.
Now, you know, endurance racing by its nature means that lap time isn't quite as important as it is in a sprint race. What's the balance between, you know, cutting the fast lap and, you know, being there at the end? There's obviously a very different approach to that.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how fast they go.
I'm not surprised, don't worry.
Yeah, obviously, we're one of the few manufacturers now that can just, we can use the open tyre rule, so that we've got Dunlop, Pirelli, Michelin and Bridgestone if they want to come there. So, and that's all factory tyres as well. So the tyres that we get are probably, you know, equal to some of the best in any championship in the world. And the pace is quite hot. The rules, the bikes are obviously a little bit less highly tuned than in World Superbike, but that's to get the the endurance
reliability,
the reliability out of it.
Durability. Mm. Mm. So when you see guys at a race meeting like this, you know, busting themselves to get that last tenth of a second in qualifying, is that quite so important in WEC?
It is, because the front guys are very, very competitive. And in France, World Endurance is probably more important than MotoGP and World Superbike. I mean, we get 120,000 people coming to places like Le Mans and the Bol d'Or. So it is big, big business, and there's big, big money if you win there. So it's, you know, like the guys do go for those bonuses as well. You know, if you get pole position, you get a bonus. And, you know, when you can make a living off of two races a year, which the French guys do, you know, there's big bonuses for everything, because France is still a place where if you know, Suzuki wins on Sunday, they sell on Monday.
So what is it with France? I mean, France has always been the hotbed of endurance racing. Going back, as I said to you in the introduction, going back to the days of, you know, Gaudier and Jeannot, 1973, 74, what is it with France in endurance racing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's the nature of the people down there. I mean, they're big into the Paris-Dakar. They're big into a lot of weird and wonderful motorsports and things, and
Le Torquay.
Yeah, so Tour de France. You know, they're into these big long races, which, you know, it's fine by me that somebody's got the passion, because if it was you know, left to other countries, Spain, or, you know, like it is dying down a little bit around the world at the moment, but we have had some good teams come back. Honda Britain have come in now with pretty much a full, very good effort. You know, BMW see it as a valid championship as well. So, you know, although it's died off a little bit recently, it is definitely making a comeback. I see it's on TV here in Speed in Australia. I didn't even know that. So, you know, it's there. Why the French like it, I don't know. Just glad they do.
Sure. And Australian participation in WEC?
Yeah, more people than you would imagine, actually. I mean, Warwick, obviously, there's Warwick Nowlan that used to do it. Damien Cudlin's there. His brother Alex Cudlin are there. From time to time, we get the odd guy popping in, Glenn Richards.
There's their sister.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, so we do get the odd Aussie face. Glenn Richards sometimes pops in and does it. You know, and it's also the championship. I mean, where, you know, I can remember James Ellison has been there in the past, and he still does the odd one here and there. Josh Hayes, the American Superbike champion, has been in recent years, and not last year, the year before, come and done one. So, you know, like, people do come and do these races, and they hold a fascination to a lot of these, you know, top flight riders.
What about an endurance race in Australia?
Love to have one here. Let's make it happen.
Well, I've been talking to Warwick a lot, and he's really keen.
Well, you know, we've got the track. There's already an 8-hour race here. Let's make it happen. I'm keen to come here and race, you know, in the 8-hour race in, you know, December or whenever it is, because, you know, it's a fantastic circuit. Be a great feel. I think if you had the, you know, the international contingent here as well, you'd get a big crowd down. I'd like to see it happen.
Steve Martin, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time, and hope you have a great weekend here at the Island Classic.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, well, it's Phil Hall again reporting from the 19th Island Classic here at Phillip Island in Victoria, Australia. And I've got international rider and member of the of Team GB, rider of GS1000S number 67, David Taylor. David, welcome to Australia, welcome to Phillip Island, and thanks for sparing us the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's a great privilege to ride on what is probably one of the world's great race tracks. Certainly when I was asked if I was interested in riding here, I didn't need asking twice. Fantastic place, but I've got to say, more of a challenge than I expected. It really is quite something special, and despite quite a lot of time spent on YouTube videos looking at onboard laps and such like, you get no real idea about the elevation of the place. Uphill, downdale, fantastic.
So Dave, tell us the Dave Taylor story in Precy form. You know, where have you come from? You know, what sort of stuff have you done in your career? You know, where are you heading? You know, what's your plan for 2012?
Right, okay, well, I'm, as you can probably gather from my accent, an Englishman. I've been racing for, this is my 19th race season, and I started racing because if I hadn't have gone racing, I would surely have been either locked up or dead, as I was one of those guys on the roads who really thought that it was actually a racetrack. that was really going nowhere, so I got myself a race licence back in 1994 and started racing, and initially it was just a view to getting the speed thing out of my system, do a few races here and there, you know, enjoy it, and then, you know, grow up and do other things. And unfortunately, I've never grown up. So 19 years further down the line, here I am. And I was fortunate enough, as we are in England, to have the Isle of Man on our doorstep. And in 1992, I went to watch. And I've never forgotten the experience. I didn't know very much about road racing, and closing public roads to go racing on is not something that is widespread throughout the world in this safety-conscious era that we've now got. So I went to watch, and I was absolutely mesmerised by the spectacle. And in the back of my mind was the idea that if I got a race licence, then I might just have a dabble at a bit of road racing. Just the once, you understand? And yes, exactly. And I'm going to be competing in my, I think it's my 16th Manx Grand Prix this year, which is kind of like the TT for amateurs. So that, in a nutshell, is pretty much it. 19 years of racing, mostly in England, but I've been lucky enough to race here at Phillip Island in this meeting. Been to Bathurst, raced in New Zealand. Plan for this year also is to hopefully compete at another one of the world's great racetracks at Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium, which is another quite spectacular place to wheel a motorcycle out of the garage and go completely insane. So, yeah, that's the plan. And, of course, back to the Isle of Man, as always, this year. That drives the whole season.
And Spa, what's the nature of the meeting at Spa? I know the classic racing guys run an endurance race around Spa on the old bikes. Is this sprint racing, or are you going endurance racing?
It's the endurance race idea is one that a friend of mine, who I had previously circuit endurance race with in England, said to me, Dave, how do you fancy going to Spa to race? I was like, sounds like a nice idea, tell me some more. So we're hoping to get an entry, but we understand that the meeting is oversubscribed. So if we get a start, great. If we don't, well, you know, there's always next year.
What is the attraction with riding the older bikes, Dave?
It's really a bit strange how it all came about. Basically, what happened with the older machinery was that I've always ridden modern bikes, Supersport 600, 750s, Formula 400, that kind of thing. And then about 3 years ago in the island, they introduced an additional class called Post Classic. And the idea of it was that as classic competitor entries were starting to fall, it's just, you know, kind of, I suppose, an age thing maybe, they wanted something to plug the competitor shortfall, and the idea was floated that post-classic racing would be a good idea. And as post-classic bikes get a practice session separate from the modern bikes, I thought, in a rather naive way, great, this would be a really cheap way of getting twice as much practice. And of course, having started on what we now call post-classic bikes back in 1978-79 on a GS750, I thought, oh, I'll go out and buy something like that, and away we go. And I bought a GS1000, which was pretty much a rolling wreck, and then started stripping it with a view to rebuilding, and very quickly the bills mounted to an insane level. So, of course, in consequence, my post-classic Suzuki GS1000 is actually the most expensive race bike I've ever owned or put together. But the attraction of it, I guess, is that it's a much more gentlemanly affair. It's post-classic racing than the cutthroat Supersport 600 environment. And, of course, the nostalgia effect, I've been amazed by. People just love to see these old machines rolling around the place. And I guess it takes us all back to our youth. Well, certainly it does with me.
Yeah, me too.
So that's the reason behind the GS1000. But of course, I've landed myself in very, very hot company here at Phillip Island. Ex Grand Prix racers such as Jeremy McWilliams here, and international road racers like Ryan Farquhar, and of course, the Australian contingent isn't too short of talent either. So there's some pretty quick guys there, and the popularity of post-classic racing means that there's some very, very fast people on track. So it's been a fairly dramatic introduction to how things are done down under.
And some very expensive bikes too, Dave.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think nostalgia comes at a very high price. But the reality of it is that the pleasure to be had from witnessing some of these machines being ridden absolutely on the edge is really a sight to behold. Fantastic stuff. Real pleasure. I've watched Ryan and Jeremy come by me at considerable speed, I hasten to add, once or twice in the practice sessions this morning. It's just dazzling to witness proper Grand Prix type talent absolutely on the edge of the tyres, and the breathtaking speed that they're carrying. It's one thing to look at it from behind a catch fence and a gravel trap, and another thing to have them brush past probably, you know, a racing close, like say 4 or 5 inches. It's really quite something, and these blokes are very, very talented.
Now, of course, Dave, you also wear another hat because you are also an ambassador for the Manx TT, which we should qualify. What you said before is that the Manx is run on the same course as the Isle of Man TT, but it's for the amateur, non-professional riders, and it's generally regarded as the way that you get your toe into the water for riding on the island. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yes, a few years back, the club invited some of the regular competitors if they would mind, in effect, preaching the gospel to the people who were thinking whether or not to stick their toes in the water with regard to road racing. And the mountain course, all 37 and three quarters miles of it, it's a formidable place to go and race a bike. The good bit about it is that unlike a normal circuit type race, it's not a grid start, it's an interval start, hence the Appellation TT Tourist Trophy. It's in effect a time trial, and the Manx Grand Prix is effectively the TT for amateurs, so we get to go completely bonkers on the hallowed environment that so many great names down the years have actually competed on, participated on. And the one thing that always occurs to me, certainly when I roll up to the start line in the island, when the marshal's hand is on your shoulder about to indicate you to start, is that effectively you're treading in the footsteps of history. There's been some great, great races there, and the names are legendary. So my job, if you want to call it that, in that respect, is to try and encourage other people to participate and derive the racing pleasure that I've had, very fortunately, for the last 15 years of racing on the mountain course. An amazing place to race, probably the one thing that anyone with a racing license should try once. It's just beyond words for me, and as you can tell, I'm a big enthusiast of it.
What about the danger aspect of it, David? I mean, the mountain has been incredibly cruel.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it would be remiss of me to not comment on the fact that if you get it wrong, your likelihood of walking away is considerably reduced from your chances on a short circuit. This year is the 30th anniversary of an Australian rider called Kenny Blake, who unfortunately met his sad end on the circuit. And in Britain, we are very familiar with the consequences of mountain course racing. But, and I would say it's a very, very big but, nobody forces anyone to compete. Every year, entries are oversubscribed. The reality of it is, when I try and explain it to newcomer riders, I try and put it like this. Imagine that it's Sunday morning and it's a nice sunny day, and the police turn up on your doorstep and they go, "Good morning. We've closed the roads for the next 40 miles. Go out and do what you like. There's no other traffic out there. None of it's going oncoming to you, so you don't need to worry. Oh, and by the way, we put a flag marshal on every corner to tell you whether or not the road surface is good." And that's what it's like. You ride your own race. And Periodically, you will see other riders, but the 10-second interval start system and the seeding system generally keeps quite a lot of us apart. Occasionally, you do get into a bit of a dice with people, and it's very entertaining when you do, but it's not like that complete melee that you get at the first corner where 30 or 40 of you are jostling for the same bit of tarmac on the apex of the corner that you believe you have a God-given right to. None of that kind of thing happens. And that, of course, means you can ride your own race, and because the lap is so long, typically if a newcomer rider can get round at over 100 miles an hour in the first 2-3 sessions, then they're going pretty well, and that's about 23 minutes. And if you have a lap that long, then the potential for getting into your own zone and concentrating and relaxing on the task in hand is right there on a plate for you. Whereas, of course, in competitive grid start racing, you're always wondering who's behind you, can you catch that guy in front, etc., etc. You're jostling for position. Doesn't happen on the mountain course in that way. And we all have a considerable degree of respect for one another. Anyone who actually does engage in the short circuit tactics of stuffing it under someone on the brakes on the way into a turn quickly gets hauled in front of the clerk of the course and illustrated the error of their ways with a bit of a slap on the wrist, metaphorically speaking.
Dave, we are fortunate here that we get to see a lot of the true road racing on cable TV, and I must admit, as a non-racing rider, it scares the squids out of me. Can you learn the mountain course, and if you can, how do you do it?
You're right about the fact that it does appear to be a dangerous spectacle, and I would say that it does take a bit of learning. I would say that at a minimum it takes you probably about 3 years to learn the course, and that is to learn it in a very general fashion. And the way that you do that is you break it down into sections. There are some sections where effectively you can pretty much see every bend in front of you. The mountain section of the course is very much like that, but somewhat surprisingly to people who have witnessed TV coverage, the mountain course isn't actually the fastest section of the course. If you have a look at things like split lap times, it's the low level sections where the big speeds are built up, and those are the technically challenging sections. And you have to break it down into sections to learn it, because everyone has a finite amount of memory, and you can't swallow the Encyclopedia Britannica in one hit. Nope. You know, you've got to dine on several courses.
Yep.
And the idea here is that you have a look at a circuit section, you try to learn it, and then when you think you've learnt it to a particular level, move on to the next section that you're going to learn. And that tends to pay dividends. One of the things that can frequently lull you into a false sense of security is that if in your first year, your newcomer year, you have a really good result, frequently there is an inclination to believe that you've now learnt the course. And that is absolutely not the case. It would, I would say, conservatively, be your most dangerous year is your second year, where you think you know where you're going, and you've had a couple of, you know, maybe good lap times and good results, and you think, yeah, you know, I'm into this.
I've got it.
That is when you can trip yourself up in a very big way.
And when you think you've arrived, you're probably at the wrong station.
Yeah, that's right. As everyone tends to appreciate, that if you make a mistake on one corner, recovering that error in some of the faster sections like Bishop's Court, for example, that error will take you 2-3 miles potentially to recover. And the idea that you can actually make up the ground on the next corner is surely a recipe for disaster, something that we actively discourage. We try to get guys to think about it in a calm and measured fashion and to learn it in their own good time.
The Manx meeting, of course, is the ideal way to do that.
Absolutely it is. Yeah, it's no pressure in that regard. The only pressure that is on you is put on by yourself. As most racers, in fact, I would have thought every racer would tell you, there is always next year. And that is no more true on the MGP TT Mountain Circuit than anywhere else in the world. And I would actually challenge the danger element of it in some respects. I believe, in all honesty, that some of the other road courses are far more dangerous by simple virtue of the fact that you're racing on a grid start. I've been fortunate enough to race at some of the great road circuits, the Northwest 200, the Ulster Grand Prix, the Southern 100, and they are wonderful circuits, but you absolutely must be cognizant of what your fellow competitors are doing. On the mountain course, interval start, you don't need to worry.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. As I say, we do get to see some of it here. And those tiny little circuits in Northern Ireland they race on, where they race mass grid starts, you just can't get your head around how they can do that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say that that the Irish, and somewhat paradoxically the New Zealanders, are pretty much in the same league in that regard. New Zealand street racing and Irish road racing have some considerable similarities in that the circuits are small, tight, have all the hazards of roads, and are grid starts. So, it's no surprise that, for example, Bruce Anstey,
yes,
the Kiwi rider from Wellington, is, in my personal opinion, one of the great TT road racers, and he, I assume, is a New Zealand street racer as well. So, you know, it's a good training ground. The Irish guys come over to the Manx Grand Prix and believe that the circuit is like a motorway, because they're used to riding on things that are so tight. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
If you were able to take both hands off the bars at somewhere like Skerries, you could probably touch the hedges on both sides. It's really quite something. So that would possibly be a step too far for me in terms of road racing danger. But yeah, mountain course, fantastic place to race. Wholeheartedly recommend it to any competitor.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for sparing us the time. I know you're very busy. It's Friday. It's practice day, qualifying day, and you've got to have your head about it and your race face. And we really appreciate that you've taken the time to talk to us and give us some insight into something that is probably foreign to 98% of us. So really appreciate your time and wish you well. Hope you do well in your individual races. I'm not going to wish you quite so well in the International Challenge, because I've got to back the Aussies. But welcome to Phillip Island. And it's great to have you here, and many thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here, and I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. Okay, well, it's Phil Hall reporting for MotoPod podcasts here from the 19th Annual Island Classic at Phillip Island in Melbourne, Australia, and speaking with international rider Ed Hazer. Welcome to Phillip Island and welcome to Australia, Ed.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Ed, what's your impressions?
It's just mind-blowing. This event here is so big compared to anything I've ever participated in. It's just a real treat. It's really special.
And Ed, the team and, you know, the structure that you've got here with Roger and the crew?
Roger Gunn is like, you know, he's the most generous person ever. Just, you know, he just offered up two bikes for me and Jimmy Mack to come and race and beat the crap out of him, you know, and just try to go as fast around the track as possible without any restrictions. Just go as fast as you want to go and don't crash him and have fun. And it's just amazing that somebody is, you know, willing to offer that kind of stuff up, because I know I'm protective of my bikes. And for somebody to just hand you a bike and say, go for it, is just really neat. It's priceless.
And Ed, the track, Phillip Island, nothing that you've seen on YouTube or television can really prepare you for what the track is actually like when you actually have to ride it?
No, when I was watching a few YouTube videos, and it's, unless you ride it yourself, I didn't have any reference points whatsoever. You can play all the games in the world you want on the computer, it's not going to do it justice. It is really a special track. Really fast, really smooth compared to what we run on in the United States, and just a real treat to be here, you know. On a fast bike too, on top of that. It's not a, that bike is pretty darn good.
And Ed, the elevation changes, I think you said, was one of the things that caught you by surprise with the track more than anything else.
Well, the elevation change is not so bad, but there are some turns you kind of, you know, you come over a rise and it's off camber and you don't really know how long the turn is. There's lots of long, winding turns here that are high speed where you're accelerating up, and, you know, until you kind of know where the track is going, you're not willing to, at least I'm not willing to, really open it up yet. But after doing a number of practice sessions, now I'm feeling pretty confident going around the track.
This is no modern day, you know, built for television go-kart track. This is a real fair dinkum road racing track.
If you're easily scared, then you're not going to be going fast at this track, that's for sure.
And Ed, the competition, what have you noticed with what you've seen?
There's a big variety of competitors out here, but I think, you know, I'm somewhere in the middle of the pack. I'm not the fastest, I'm not the slowest, so I'm just trying to improve my times. I think I can, you know, kind of get a little bit further towards the front of the middle. That's what I'm aiming for, and if I can get in the 40s, if I can do a 49, I'll be extremely happy.
And, you know, it's a good team structure that Roger's got. You know, the mechanics, I've just been sitting in the pits with you the last 3 days. The mechanics seem to be on the game with what they need to do when they need to do it. There's no sort of panicking and so forth happening there.
No, it's a very mellow setup there. Like you said, there's nobody's freaking out. They know, these guys know exactly when they need to do what to get the bike out on time, and I don't really have to worry about too much of the stuff. We had a few issues with my bike. The battery went dead at the end of the day during qualifying, and we had a carburetor issue, but those both should be solved now, and I'm just going to go out. I missed the first session this morning, but I'm going to go out in a bit and do the last qualifying session for the International Challenge, and I think the bike will be railing out there. I think it's going to go pretty good.
Well, Ed, it's been a great pleasure to have you here. I'm not going to hold you up because I know you got qualifying for the International Challenge very soon, but it's been great to meet you because we've talked on Facebook for a year now, and I know the interest that you've taken in the project that I'm doing, and I've got to say it's been a real pleasure to just hang around with you guys and watch the way that you go about business and bring back some more American riders next year.
Well, likewise, and the offer is already on the table for us to come back next year and with more guys and maybe do a USA team, so that'll be just a real treat to come back here again. I mean, once is already amazing, but if I can come back here again another time, I'd just be ecstatic. It just would make my year. This track is just one of a kind. I mean, I thought Assen was going to be my favorite, but this one beats Assen, I think, by a mile.
Okay, Ed, thank you very much. I'll let you get back to it, and good to talk to you, and I look forward to hearing you your impressions after you've actually been out there and raced.
Sounds good.
All right, so massive, massive thanks to Phil Hall for getting us those. Very, very cool. He's obviously a seasoned interviewer, and it's great to get that kind of stuff. You know, Ryan Farquhar, Jeremy McWilliams, lots of good stuff. We're going to try and have a talk with Jeremy shortly, which will be very cool, considering he's going to be doing a CRT gig. What else going on? A little bit of stuff in World Superbike, huh?
Yeah, they've the Superbike grid's up to 24 riders with World Super Sport, which a couple of years ago was starting to shrink alarmingly, is up to 32. So despite credit crunches and current economic climates, looking very good across the World Superbikes. And in other news, going back to our earlier Ant West conversation, lots of talk that he and Norrie Hager might be coming to BSB.
I think I'm looking forward to that.
Just rumors at the moment. But, yeah, as a friend of the show and occasional co-host, Guy Anderson said, that'd be nice, an Aussie and BSB I can actually like. which led to a whole conversation about the ins and outs and ups and downs of Josh Brooks. Brilliant to watch him riding, provided your name's not Sylvain Guintoli. Although, of course, Sylvain didn't see him coming. That was the problem.
Yep. There's been a whole flurry too of press releases for team launches lately. And carry on. I will diverge here. I'm trying to keep it short.
Sure. But it's weird, isn't it? I've never known a silly season that's gone on this late.
Yeah.
And it's still going on. And also some very sad news. TT Racer and Honda Legends rider Keith Amor has been forced to retire with a shoulder injury. I mean, he's 39, so maybe some people will be feeling that at least he hasn't been forced to retire and he's still really young, but it sounds like he was really gutted. He had a series of injuries last year and had a shoulder injury that, after long consultation with doctors, Keith decided to hang up his leathers, and very, very popular guy.
I asked Mark Miller, I said, so when you pass out on a bus at Macau next year, who's going to carry you up to your hotel room?
Yeah, exactly. Good friends with Johnny Ray, I believe, Keith Amor. In fact, wasn't that one of the James Whittam stories that he was at the TT and looked along and thought, that's Johnny Ray? And said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm just boarding for Keith.
Yeah.
And he was there, real shame, real shame. But hopefully he'll stay involved. And
a brilliant writer. Somebody that's really, really been on it for a long, long time. So a tip of the hat from MotoPod to you, Keith Amor. And I hope you'll stay in the business in one capacity or another.
Absolutely. And we also heard this week that Ian Hutchinson, who, of course, features heavily in the Closer to the Edge TT 3D film, broke his leg this week. Again, motocross injury. And is likely to be out for 4 months. So
but
he's
actually not a motocross injury. He was at a show in the UK doing a demo ride. And
I got the wrong end of the stick there.
Yeah, the worst thing that could have happened. And it was the same leg that he broke before, but apparently it is not at the same place, which is a great sign. We're still kind of waiting for information on what his recovery period might be, but yeah, definitely a drag. But again, we're looking at June for the TT, or and prior to that for Northwest 200. So hopefully he'll be good to go at that point. It's clear.
I should have given the credit to MCN there for the 4 month bit, and as soon as you're saying that was in MCN, people know. Well, you don't necessarily have to believe it.
Yeah.
Sorry, Matt, but.
Well, it depends on if Matt wrote the story or not. Bertie was over at Sepang for that entire deal, so he may not have had the full scoop. But I have a feeling he'll be back, and I'm not too worried. And he certainly got the spirit, especially after what he went through last year, and especially after his incredible run at Macau this year, or yeah. I guess last year. I'm not worried at all about Hutchie coming back. I think he'll be there.
Yeah, certainly hope so.
Yeah. What else do we have? I don't know. Did we just finish the show, Martin?
I think we might have done.
Oh, good Lord.
Well, it's a good job. I just finished my Guinness.
Oh, well, I've still got a bit of this German beer over. All right. I want to thank everybody out there in Monopod land. And next week, I promise... I will have a list of donors because there have been some very, very generous people lately. Some people have actually donated week over week, which I thought was absolutely astounding and amazing. You can also always do so through the Facebook fan page at facebook.com/motopod or through motopodcast.com. We highly encourage you to hang out with us and have a chat on Facebook. It is a great little community, and I think it's, as we say, 10,000 plus strong. Last I looked, it was 10,025. And I'm sure, Martin, by the time this show gets on, we're going to be well over that. Very, very neat to see that blossoming. And many thanks to Jules for taking care of the show and cleaning things up and making things sound better than they do. And I'm looking forward to hearing this one. There's parts of it that I haven't heard yet that I want to hear. So I'm kind of stoked.
Yeah. And looking forward, let's not forget, in 3 weeks and one day, we will have a World Superbike race. FP1 will start at Phillip Island. And in 3 weeks and 3 days, we'll have two World Superbike races and a World Supersport race to watch.
Absolutely. And Chris Pike,
can't wait.
Chris Pike, I know you're out there. I'm going to get you on. I know you're evading me. He said, yes, I'll talk to you. And then he's like, yeah, well, you know, we don't want to talk yet. I'm going to get you a pipe. All right. So huge congratulations and enjoyment from the first test of the year. It kind of gets our blood boiling again, doesn't it, Martin?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're always going to put far too much weight on the stuff that goes on there because we've been starved for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Months. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have to. We basically have to make shit stuff up for a period of time until we get into the actual deal. So, Motopod fans out there, thanks a bunch. Again, join us on Facebook or Google Plus if you want to, and we will talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Good night, everybody.
Good day, everybody.
Ding ding, ding ding, ding ding ding. Ding.
I wonder if they might change. you know, Doc, I'm just ain't working anymore, man. Like, this fuck is up. And, like, you know, we emptied it down, and all of a sudden it ain't working anymore.
Kind of rooting around, favouring it just a little.
Yeah, just a bit, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it was really, really close when I decked the engine casing, because the front let go.
Yes.
I picked it up and only just stayed on track.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I can now actually pick up small coins off the floor with my sphincter.